to the Buddha, to the Dharma, to the Sangha. I'll just pick up where I left off with the last reading I did. Just on the first full paragraph of page 97. It is 4 o'clock in the morning. I know that the journey is about to continue, but I do not wish to awaken one of my disciples, although I know he has to be here. He comes in when I call him, and the journey continues. From where I am now, I can see the back of the emanation of the cosmic Buddha. I and the golden monk are standing to the right of 4 yellow golden rays. I look up and perceive that 3 of these rays come forth from a bright place within golden-edged clouds. The 4th ray comes forth from a tiny white spot in a patch of absolutely black sky. The 4 rays touch the back of the emanation. The emanation is the great kind of perceived figure of Buddha, clearly representing the cosmic Buddha, the eternal. I know that I must close my eyes. I feel something compelling them to close. My disciple has his back to me, the disciple who's with her at the time. I'm not sure who that was, actually. It may have been Ramesser Daisley, it may have been someone else, I don't know. I think it was probably Ramesser Daisley, but I'm not sure. Somehow we both know that this must not be seen with mortal eyes. I do not know what to do, and he, the disciple, asks the Lord if he may see what I should do without looking at me, and is told he may. I ask what to do, and am told, be content, do not seek to go higher. Wholeheartedly I answer, I am content. As I say this, my entire body is thrilled through and through with liquid light. It enters through every pore, through fingers, toes, head, sides, through every orifice of my body. 5 times the light thrills through me. I ask before each one, what more may I do? Finally it gathers and pierces me in the hara, but I feel no pain. I ask, how may I show my gratitude to the Buddhas and ancestors? And am told with a smile, you always wanted to be a real monk. Great clouds of yellow gold pass in waves over my closed eyes. This is the first place that we're introduced to in a formal way to the teaching of the 5 columns. It's going to be coming very soon now. And they're introduced in the beginning as 4 of the 5, 3 coming down directly from a bright place in the sky, another coming down less directly from the side through a black place in the clouds, a very dark place. That one coming from the side, from a very dark place, is the first of the 5 columns. The other 3 are the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. The 5th one is not manifest yet, and yet has been there all along, as we'll be seeing. Now this is the thing that I mentioned it this morning earlier. But I'll say it again. This is a really wonderful thing about this, is that this teaching is being given to her master, and she doesn't yet know what it is. This is not the first time this has happened. It's being given to her, and she doesn't yet know what it is. And she's not speculating. She He's not, there's no speculation here as to what these things mean. She's going to be shown what they mean in incredible detail and in many aspects. And it is the, I don't know, the very distillation of the whole of contemplative life and aspiration in one of the most magnificent ways that's ever been voiced in human history is in the teaching of the five columns. I've said a number of times in this series of talks that I really believe that Reverend Master was being a vessel or vehicle for the teaching from the eternal for all of us who follow in her footsteps. And that she, when she went to Japan, she had asked or she had expressed her wish to realize the perfection of Zen. And then she had lived her life in a way since that time that showed her commitment to that goal. And she is being given the perfection of Zen, the perfection of the spiritual life. And it's not, you know, it's not some kind of magic. That perfection. You know, what is it, you know, what is it we actually need to do this? You know, to do our part in the spiritual process. You know, we need a teaching and we need a practice. The teaching gives us the guidelines of how to do the practice. And the practice is what we actually do. So the teaching that's starting to come at this point is really the teaching about deeper spirituality and how to live in the harmony with the eternal that Reverend Master has now realized. How to retain what has been realized. How to retain it, how to protect it, how to guard it, how to treasure it, and how to allow it to continually deepen. I said in I think the talk before the last one that I did, that this point of contentment is incredibly important. And I alluded to this point we're at now, where a master says, I am content, and is then you'll see how she puts it later, but I'll just say that this experience that she's describing here, and she describes it as well as anyone could describe it in words, understanding that really it can't be in the end described in words. It is a description of being completely reclaimed by the eternal. You know, no part of her body and mind is left out of it. Listen to what she says. Wholeheartedly I answer, I am content. As I say this, my entire body is thrilled through and through with liquid light. It enters through every pore, through fingers, toes, head, sides, through every orifice of my body. Five times the light thrills through me. Well, why five times? So five columns again. You know, this... I suppose you could read this like this is something kind of incredibly esoteric thing happening. But that's not how she ever viewed it, and it's certainly not how I view it. This is just a human being's birthright happening here. And she's going through another round here of being again in effect asked, do you want to go further or do you want to stay with what you've got? And in this case, the way to go further is to actually be content, not to strive to go further. Notice that previously she'd asked, as each time the light thrills through her, she asks before each one, what more may I do? And again she experiences the wave of the love of the eternal, which is what this is. This great wave of the love of the eternal. There's a willingness to do more, and it's not asking her to do any more. It's enough to be content. And she's not, notice that she's not asking for more heaven or more bliss or anything. She's content with whatever. This contentment is the big contentment with a capital C. You know, thy will be done. Not my will, but thine. Those who've read her Master Mokigen's diary, when she gets to the point, she describes that it actually happened down here in the wetland, on the edge of the wetland there. She remembers the exact place where it happened. She had it come up, the words that came up for her were, so be it. And there is it's just this act of pure acceptance, a pure acceptance of the will of the eternal, and complete surrender to that will, surrender of all self will. And then the eternal takes you back completely, your mind completely. Now here is what I have to show you. Here is what I have to teach you. And so, not surprisingly, this amazing teaching floods forth from this point again. You know, this is not the first point at which Rear Master has made such a choice. And it's always been the choice to go on and to continue to follow the eternal rather than follow any selfish desire or ambition. This is our offering of love to the eternal. And that enables the eternal to show us its love for us. She says, I asked my disciple, what is happening? And he says, he sees a kind of ordination. There is an exquisite golden kesa in the sky. When the time comes for me to open my eyes, the highly colored robes I have been wearing will no longer be there. Instead, there will be the form of a monk. He says, it will soon be time for me to go back down. This is the last such journey I shall take for a while. I ask what I should do and am told to go back to the sea. My work is to be a gardener who helps the lotus blossoms to grow straight. Her master is very factual in her writing and does not usually say very much about how she feels about things. And I would only be speculating to, and I'm not going to do so, about how she feels here about kind of going back to ordinary daily life after such an experience. I will say that it's not uncommon for people to really not want to do that. And and yet it would be a mistake to try to hold on to anything. It is a mistake to try to hold on to anything. Now maybe, and most likely at this point, this was not an issue for a master. Maybe on later on it was. I don't know. I know for myself, whenever been fortunate enough to do a number of deep retreats in my years as a monk. And every time I've come out of them, I've always hit the same wishing I didn't have to come out of it and fear of losing something when I go back into ordinary daily life again. And I've learned that you have to be willing to follow the eternal, even if you do seem to lose something. The following of the eternal has to be more important than anything. It has to be more important than anything. And interestingly enough, it's a way to really not lose anything that really matters. Always remember that just as no form of pain lasts forever, so no form of bliss lasts forever. The experience that Rim Master has described here, the being really completely reclaimed, as it were, by the eternal, is certainly one of the most exquisite things, maybe the most exquisite thing a human being can experience. And you truly do not care whether you live or die. It's so much greater. And yet, no one who's got to the point where this happens would dream of doing anything irresponsible, like trying to die in order to try to hold on to something like this. There's always a going on, and there's always a letting go as you go on, letting go of the past, going on into the unknown. She says, I go at once to Shasta's meditation hall. She didn't kind of hang around doing nothing. She's back to work here. Just before the Kaishaku sound, that's the clapping of the wooden blocks for the end of meditation, I find myself again in the Buddha land. I am standing both on the high sacky of Shasta's Hondo, that's the ceremony hall. I'm standing on the central bowing mat in the ceremony hall, and simultaneously on that of the Daikaido of the Buddha land. I don't know why these terms aren't translated in English, but Dai means great. Kaido probably means great ceremony hall or something along those lines, or meditation hall of the Buddha land. She's simultaneously standing in the ceremony hall at Shasta and in the Buddha land. The Sangha stretches to infinity in both directions on either side of me in ranks of five. The first four rows on each side are golden, both of body and robes. Then come those wearing colored robes and those in black, stretching back and back, lost in the shadows of the great hall. On the altar is the same emanation of the cosmic Buddha that I have seen in the sky, and Shakyamuni, clad in white, stands with him as before. He comes and goes from the emanation to me many times during the ceremony, as if teaching me what to do. I am very afraid to look up, but all are gentle and accept me completely. I do not need to fear rejection. Now I know that when we say homage to the Buddha, it is a cosmic Buddha embracing all Buddhas of which we speak. Cosmic Buddha was a term our master used around this time, not infrequently, to refer to the eternal. Later on she changed it to the eternal. Later on she used more of the term the unborn. As her life and teaching went on from this point, she chose a more kind of, I wouldn't even say impersonal, but transpersonal ways of referring to the eternal. Homage to the Dharma is homage given to the teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha in this world. Homage to the Sangha is homage given to all beings who train themselves to reach the waveless sea and then go beyond to the true monastery of the Lord of the House. The true monastery of the Lord of the House is your own true heart. She says, there is but one Sangha, pure and undivided. Men and women, no matter of what school of Buddhism, meet there as equals before the Lord and are greeted by the great monks with respect. As I recite the ancestral line, I only catch a fleeting glimpse of the seven Buddhas. But from Makakasho on, the golden monks answer to their names, Makakasho, Ananda, Shonawashu, etc. They are all here, the first five on my left, the next five on my right, then back again to the left. Each recognizes me in turn. Some wonder why I stopped to bow at their names. They are but monks as I. From here on I must make no bows when I recite their names. What I was taught concerning such things in Sojiji does not apply. Now I must learn what the Lord wishes to be done and not concern myself with worldly sectarianism. The most excellent Mir Samadhi speaks truth. Separated do the sects become by setting up of doctrines, practices, and these become the standards that we know of all religious conduct. Even should we penetrate these doctrines, practices, and then delusive consciousness flows through the eternal truth, no progress shall we make. From now on I will sit up straight in the presence of the Buddhas and ancestors, as is their will. I go outside the temple. The beings in their highly colored robes, or their highly colored clothes, stroll along the shore. I still have not seen the color of my robes. I've always remembered the day when River Master got us together and told us that although she'd always done these bows during the morning service ceremony, she wouldn't be doing them from then on, and just told us about this experience. Told us about this experience and said that this is the way that she would be doing it from that point. And I'm trying to remember. I cannot remember whether she made any recommendation for others doing celebrant at that time or in future date with regard to those bows. Myself, I always do them. And I've often, you know, thought of her choice not to do them when I'm doing them. And frankly, I've never seen an opposition between the two. I've never seen one as right and one as wrong. I mean, how could it be wrong to bow? And yet you might say, yet when the heart is in a perpetual bow, how could it be wrong not to bow? It's the attitude. There's absolutely no reason why why I would question River Master's choice based on what she believed to be the teaching for her at this time. Some people might say, well, that seems to indicate pride. I don't see it that way. You have to look beyond the external appearances. There's a lovely, verse in the Bible. Man looks on the outward appearance, God looks on the heart. And there's no questioning the purity of your master's heart in this. With regard to River Master's observations about, what the real Sangha consists of, clearly, what she's saying is that the real Sangha has nothing to do with sectarianism or particular practices. That it goes beyond doctrines and practices, the real Sangha. It's those who are truly following in the path of the Buddhas and ancestors in whatever way is right for them to do so. One of the wonderful things about Buddhism is that by and large there isn't a constant fighting amongst the schools. I say by and large because, Buddhists are human too, and there has been, some fighting and some rather vicious fighting at times between Buddhist schools. But by and large, on the whole, there's more of a view that different paths are complementary to one another rather than opposing one another. And you pick the one that's right for you. And as long as you all end up in the same place, that's all that matters. That's the way her master always taught it. And I've never known her to be small-minded. I never knew her to be small-minded or negative about other people's spiritual path. At the same time, and this is the other part of this, the other half of this, is that she was firmly committed and always firmly committed to Soto Zen. And she never tried to mix just a little bit. She did experiment now and then in introducing in something from another school. Generally speaking, it didn't really take. But by and large, again, she was really careful to keep us on a nice, clean, straightforward Soto Zen path. The essential point here is that a willful sectarian narrow-mindedness is not helpful. And a willful attempt to combine what one thinks of as the best of different paths is also not helpful. One has to be well-grounded in one's own practice and content with it. And River Master always was. And one must also be, of course, why wouldn't one be, respectful of everyone else's way of doing things. It's my experience that when two people who walk seemingly very different paths but have come to the same place spiritually meet one another, there's an immediate recognition. There's just an inherent recognition. I remember way back in 1979, in the summer of 1979, when I was at Throssell, Reverend Master asked me to go to a meeting of European Buddhists in Paris. So I went over there and attended the meeting, and on the first morning, there only was a few days, we met at the United Nations Cultural UNESCO building there in Paris, in one of the big meeting rooms, really nice room. And there was maybe 100, 150 people there, maybe a couple hundred people from many different schools and traditions, and mostly lay people, some monks. But I think it was the first morning, first time I walked in, when I came in the doors, there was this old, probably Tibetan monk coming out. And I just, I just come out of the temple, so I was like, I just habitually, reflexively made gassho when I saw this old monk. And all I can say is that when I made gassho with that old monk, his eyes just lit up with love. And I just got this bath of love. And all we never said a word to each other. I just kept going. He just kept going. But I just got this little bathing of love out of that man's eyes when I made gassho like that. That's just Buddha recognizing Buddha, I guess, happening. It's my best memory of that whole event, by far and away. That didn't make me want to go do what he does, or make him want to do what I do, you see. It doesn't matter to me that I never met that individual again. See what I'm saying? It's enough just for Buddha to bow to Buddha and to walk on. Walk on your own path and be grateful for it. And don't get too creative. Don't get willfully creative, let's put it that way. What amazes me constantly in our practice is that there's plenty of room for flexibility. It's amazingly flexible. And you cannot willfully mess with it. And not really damage something. Master says, I return to my house at Shasta. I am intensely cold. I asked the monk who was with me this morning to ask what this ceremony was and learn that it was my graduation. I now know that one is ordained many times. Long ago I was ordained by the Sangha that we see in this world, and I was reordained when I was ill in Oakland and retransmitted also, both after leaving the Iron Pillar behind. Now I have been ordained again in the monastery of the Lord of the House. When and if it shall please him, I will go again for my transmission in this exquisite place. These terms, ordination, graduation, and transmission, can make what's being said here a little opaque in some ways. So I want to give a quickie little rundown of the three. Ordination. Really, we undergo an ordination whenever we make a new beginning. And maybe a better way to put it is whenever we are led by the Eternal to a new beginning. And whenever perceptual truth, with a capital P and a capital T, is reconfirmed in our heart, and our commitment to perceptual truth is reconfirmed. Whether it be a formal ordination as the world recognizes it, or something that just happens within our own heart, well, that's a I think the latter, the ones that happen just within our own heart, happen more often than the former. But that's the meaning of ordination. A deeper pointing towards the eternal and a deeper willingness to walk that path that is pointed out. The graduation, Rin Master, when she was in Japan, she did a ceremony called Zuisei. That is done no sooner, as I understand it, than 5 years after ordination. And I believe there may be a length of time, maybe 2 years after transmission also. And I feel very fortunate. That beautiful kind of blue kesa that I have, that's too short for me, and that I now only wear at particular ceremonies like an ordination or transmission. That was her Zuisei kesa. It was given to her by Koho Zenji that she gave to me. Her Master Zenji did a wonderful, painstaking job of restoring it, because it was, I wore it for years and it kind of wore it out pretty good. Zuisei is a kind of formality that Rin Master didn't feel it was necessary to carry over when she brought Soto Zen to our country, to the West. But it's a kind of a congratulatory ceremony in which a person's full priesthood is recognized, and their capacity to teach, especially their capacity to teach, is recognized. I think you have to be certified as what we call a teacher, a sensei. I believe it's a Japanese term. I don't think you have to be a roshi, or what we call a master, to do that congratulatory ceremony. But it's where you get your blue or purple kesa. And she's described as we say ceremony. It sounds like this what's happened here, actually, where the monks gather and, you know, the person's a celebrant for a ceremony. So there's clearly a recognition of, at a whole new level, as it were, directly from the Buddhas and ancestors here, of her Rin Master's validity as a teacher, of the valid path she has walked. She has walked the true path, and of her capacity to lead others in that path. You might say there's the recognition that man gives and there's the recognition that God gives. And this is the latter. Rin Master mentions transmission and the retransmission that happened after she left the Iron Pillar behind. In this context, I think the retransmission really is the as it were, face-to-face realization of the truth of the eternal. Rebbe Master sometimes referred to the ceremony of transmission as being a higher ordination. And if you remember, those have been transmitted, that in the first of the transmission ceremonies, you take the precepts again. This time, it's not as, will you keep these precepts? Yes, I will keep them, but can you keep them? Yes, I can keep this precept. I can keep these precepts. And then one can be recognized as a Buddha in one's own right. And one can be given the implements of the priesthood that represent the different aspects of being a priest and a teacher, a follower of the eternal, who can point the way for others to the eternal. You'll see that later on in the book, this is exactly what happens. Later on in the narrative. So this is just a little bit more. I'm going to take this a little longer talk than some, but I'm going to just finish this particular chapter. She says, "It is the same day. I am in a boat with Shakyamuni Buddha upon the sea. He is inspecting buds again and is very anxious that as a new gardener, I understand the importance of strong stems without which the plants will die. He is much more interested in stems than he is in flowers. The stem is the training itself. The flower is a flower of enlightenment that opens to the Son of the Eternal." Here she's being shown, pay attention to the training. Don't worry about the results of the training. The flowers will take care of themselves if you develop the stem properly. The focus always has to be on the training itself. She says, "I'm wearing black robes." Black robes are robes of the novice. A whole new beginning happening, you see, a new beginning happening. You're always just starting all over again. No matter how far you go, you're always starting anew. She says, "What joy to be a new monk in the temple of the Lord and to work in his garden. The true monk regards the world as a playground or a beautiful garden," says the transmission book. "There are no truer words." She says, "It is morning. In my eagerness to do my job yesterday, I made several mistakes which resulted in several of these precious monks being harmed. I am devastated with horror. How could I have been so stupid? It takes time to grow stems. It does not happen overnight. Because of my stupidity, I almost ruined one. As I meditate upon this grieving, the white figure descends and walks with me beside the sea. He puts an arm around me and comforts me. I must remember to ask him each time before I do something. I must remember that I am only the gardener and not think that I need no help." I have no idea what this refers to, by the way. I have no idea what this refers to. What particular event this refers to. But, you know, note, this is the way it so often happens. Right before she made the mistake, whatever it was, or the mistakes, Shakyamuni Buddha is showing her the stem, saying, really watch the training. Really watch the training. And what is it the mistake was? She missed something about the training and made a mistake as a result of it. This is so often the way it happens. Right before you're going to make a misstep, It's like the Eternal takes you aside and says, come here, bub. Watch for that one there. That could get you. And so often, we get that advice, and we just somehow go ahead and walk off the cliff anyway. That's called, what's that called? That's called being human. That's not being damned for eternity, making oneself unworthy of the love of God. That's called being human. So what happens? You know, in the incredible sensitive state she is in here, and she takes it to heart really hard, really strong, and learns from it, and does Sangha, and experiences the eternal, the love of the eternal, saying, you know, yes, you made a mistake, and let's keep going. It's not the end of the world. So many times, so many times our master did that for us, you know, her disciples. You'd go into her and say something you'd done, you know, and her master would say, yes, friend, that was mistaken. It's not the end of the world. Let's keep going. Let's keep going. So many times she did that for us. For all of us who've been fortunate to know that kind of more than forgiveness, because there was no blame there, that kind of acceptance of our humanity, it's a reminder to always remember to work on accepting the humanity of others. Buddha Siddharma, Mr. Sun.